Welcome back, everyone. It's a beautiful September day in California where I'm at. I hope it is where you're at. School has started for many people. Started the podcast back up for this fall, and blessing is today I'm with a friend, a colleague, someone I've gotten to know over the last few years that I really respect, and it's Ray Pennings, who's the co-founder of Cardis and currently serves as an executive vice president. Ray has a vast amount of experience in Canadian politics as Cardis is a think tank in Canada, but has extended his influence and his reach into the United States, which is how I got to meet him and where his work has really impacted my work. He was founding president of Edudeo and has served as chair on the board of Redeemer University College and as a board member for the Civitas Society and the Rosebud School for the Arts. Ray currently sits on the Education Committee for the Redeemer Center for Christian Scholarship and the Champion Circle for Compassionate Ottawa. Ray, but we're here to talk about education, the work that Cardis has done through the education survey. And over the last number of years, Cardis has done these surveys and a series of studies on the graduate outcomes of students from different school sectors in both Canada and the United States. You know, kind of the big maybe first question, and really appreciate you spending this time with us, is what have you found in regards to how students from private schools, in this case, or, you know, maybe even just take it as the school sectors in general, because you did public schools as well. How do they contribute to the public or common good of our communities and society? And then what are, you know, some of the different places where you see maybe some of the differences in that? So thanks, Ray, for being with us, and go to it.
Well, thanks very much, Eric, for having me. It's been a pleasure to get to know you over the last few years and your network of influence, and the people who follow your podcast are leaders in Christian education. And I count it a privilege to be able to share with you and talk a little bit about what we've been doing. We've been at this now for just shy of a decade. We'll be releasing in October our third U.S. representative sample of adult graduates, and we've done three in Canada as well. So it's quite exciting to look at the data, not just in terms of one survey, but now a decade long of data collected that shows consistent themes along the way. Of course, the very notion of public good is a contested notion these days. We live in a society in which trust is declining, and one of the criticisms often made against the non-government school sector, private schools, religious schools, homeschools, is that somehow you're opting out of society and we build trust through the common school and the public school. What's interesting to note is when you take a look at the social capital measures that come out for graduates, so relationships as adults with fellow citizens, who do they interact with, how do they engage, how do they view their neighbors, we see a very high level of bonding capital. So those who go to particularly religious schools, and all just assuming the audience is most interested in the religious schools, all default to religious schools, and then when I'm talking about a different sector, I'll mention that. So when we think of religious and Protestant Christian school graduates in particular, we see strong family life, strong church life, high levels of volunteering, high levels of charitable giving in their local community. So very strong bonding capital. Bridging capital, which is sort of a measure of how do you deal with people who think differently than you do, for the most part, again, they are equal to or slightly ahead of public school graduates. So in contrast to the argument that, you know, schools can be divisive and are taking away from trust and building of society, the data is actually showing us that as adults, graduates of Christian schools are very engaged and very concerned in terms of being involved in society for the common good. They do it somewhat differently. They're not as keen on politics. And, you know, there are some different areas where they're not as active. They don't protest as much. But when we take the net of all of the different activities, they are very, very engaged and arguably more engaged than public school graduates.
Ray, it's always been fun for me to see this and to watch this grow and to see some of the similarities between Canada and the United States in these studies, but yet, some of the uniquenesses that get pulled out from each of the countries. One of the questions I had for you, because, we kind of start and we talk about religious schools. Was there anything that, and sometimes I think you get into these sectors and we can, kind of be hard on or bash or be negative towards a different sector or another sector. Was there anything that you found like in the government school sector that was really interesting to you and really positive that you say, hey, you know what, this was a uniqueness of, government school sector, whether it be Canada or the United States, that really maybe either surprised you or was an encouragement to you?
Now we use public school graduates as a control group. So what we have are they more likely or less likely than the real objects of our study, which are non-government schools. So I want to be very careful because our methodology doesn't focus us on public schools, but in order to make the comparison, obviously you have to be drawing on some conclusions. I think it's very important, particularly for those in the religious school and even the broader school choice movement. Sometimes that has been pitted as sort of independent or non-government schools are better than public schools. And I actually, when you take a look at the data, we have, 111 measures, and you can go back on surveys and you can take a look at the different sectors and parse them. And there are areas of strength and weakness in all sectors. Certainly, even in comparatively, for instance, in STEM, Christian schools tend not to do as well in STEM subjects as public school graduates after putting in the appropriate controls. Some of that might be argued to be systemic in terms of the capacity and resources to specialize at especially the secondary school level. But I think, you can go through our data, and as I say, there are six surveys, hundreds of questions, all said and done, about 7,000-8,000 graduates. And we can parse down and look at that, and that's appropriate. I think what it speaks to is the fact that what we are all engaged in is a common task of public education. By public education, I don't mean who delivers it. I mean education for the public or for the common good. And it's interesting, when you take a look at the Education Act in Ontario or the Canadian ones. In the U.S., you take a look at the 1983 document, A Nation at Risk. You go back through history and take a look at all of the documents about the purpose of education. And you see the fact that, while on the one hand, education is affirmed as a parental right, and that's in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, Section 26. Parents have a prior right to choose kind of education shall be given to children. Education is a parental responsibility. That's foundational. But it also is a public and shared citizenship responsibility. It's in my interest that my neighbor's kid gets a good education. We're going to have a civil and a democratic society. We need to be concerned about the education for everyone. And so I think it's valuable to look at this data and not try to pick winners and losers between public schools and other government-run schools and non-government-run schools. I think it's important to step back to say, how can we engage in this common enterprise of educating the next generation for the common good, learn from and with each other in order to achieve the sort of society that can prosper and in which every individual can steward their God-given gifts and flourish together. And so I really like emphasizing the public good argument that comes from this data. And like you say, we can go through and we can find an awful lot of things in public school systems that are commendable and to be celebrated. And we ought to do that.
So Ray, as you've kind of done this research in Canada, done this research in the United States, and you've had this experience over your career and you know, public policy, you know, politics, Cardis being a think tank, you know, as people read and prepare even for this new study, you know, that you're going to release in October for the United States, you know, what would be some of the encouragement on how to use the data, how to use the information to impact, you know, exactly what you're talking about, the language of the conversation itself, potentially the policies that get passed to hopefully improve the education system as a whole and create greater opportunities for parents and students. Like, how would you encourage people as they read this and go through it and then even look at the number of years, you know, to best use this to have a positive impact, you know, on this larger conversation?
Yeah, and I think with that in mind, what's important is to take off sort of the team colors as to, you know, whether we belong to homeschool, Christian school, Catholic school, non-religious, you know, the Montessori's, the Waldorf's, the sort of elite non-religious private schools or public schools, and to say, we're in this education endeavor together. We all have a common interest. Canada and the United States, when you take a look at the OECD international rankings, the PISA scores, we don't do terribly well. We sometimes have a very parochial view of education in North America. And as I, whenever I'm on public media talking about this to the broad public, I highlight the fact that North America is the exception in the world. Take a look at the Scandinavian countries who typically come out near the top. You know, we think of socialist Sweden and all the rest. Well, more than 10% of children in socialist Sweden go to government-funded, non-government schools, what we would call private schools. We think of the challenges of inequality. Half of the children in Australia who go to non-government schools go to schools that are funded as part of overcoming inequality and are on the bottom half of the social economic ladder. And, you know, education there it's a recognition that so the sort of postal code lottery that happens in, education that's organized by school districts, inevitably, you can have one common public education system, but the school in the high, you know, in the postal code that has high average home values inevitably ends up being better supported than the one that's on the other side of the tracks. And so I think what we need to do is reframe this conversation and say, when we look at the world, North America is the exception, and we somehow think that having a single Ministry of Education bureaucracy, working in partnership with unions that represent teachers and interests there, are going to provide the sort of innovation that needs to get us from, you know, lagging around 20th to 30th spot in the world and moving us up globally. I think a modern, diverse education system looks very different than the one we're used to in North America. And I think this data provides an opportunity for us to stimulate that conversation and say, we can have education for the common good. We can have a modern education system in which there are real meaningful choices for parents. We recognize one size does not fit all. The public school is not the answer for every child, but neither is the Christian school or the Catholic school. Different children have different needs, and we can build a diverse education system, respect each other, learn from each other, and in that way, build together to get hopefully better results in the decades to come than we've had in decades past.
So you mentioned, you know, some of the European countries, especially those Scandinavian countries, and I know Canada and the United States can be different from state to province to even some of the local regions. You know, over the years that you've done this, have you seen places that, you know, are in a sense reframing this conversation and looking at more complex and diverse ways to allow parents to choose and students to kind of get those that education that you're talking about. Have you seen places in North America or come across them where it's like, you know what, this is hopeful, this is encouraging, you know, they seem to be doing good stuff and are on the right track?
I'm not sure there's any one jurisdiction that's leading the pack over and above. You know, historically, we have pointed to Alberta in Canada as being one of the most generous in terms of public support for education, but that system has had its challenges as well. Certainly in the United States, over the last number of years, a lot of the voucher systems and grants have allowed for students also dealing with those who are underprivileged and don't necessarily having the means. So there are a lot of individual schools that are great models, but I don't think at a systemic wide level in North America we have done anything more than tinker. I think we need far more foundational reflection, and that's not going to start with the policymakers. That's going to start with a broader public conversation. And I don't think at this point we have the imagination yet to think in North America outside of the box and outside of our frame of reference, in which there's going to be one dominant public school system and those who don't like it opt out. That's the wrong frame of mind if we're going to change education as a whole. We're not opting out of public education. We're buying in. We're buying into education for the common good. And we need to sell our products. We need to sell the successes of our students. And we need to recognize that we're not doing this just to get the best bang for our buck or because of an exercise of parental rights or we don't like something going on in the public school. No, we're doing this for our neighbors and for our country's good.
Now that, Ray, that's a great point. And just even the idea of caring about the broader picture, but then even just having the imagination for a broader conversation, it seems like, you know, whether there was some energy behind that, you know, for the last 15 years or so, that there has been a stalling out or just a fatigue that comes with some of that imagination and some of that conversation. You know, as you release this data for the United States in this third study, how what's next for you as you kind of share this and get this out there, and what's next for you and for Cardis as you think about, you know, what we've added to this conversation, you know, what are the things that, you know, you're doing or thinking about as you take it forward to maybe increase the imagination of not only educators, but also of parents and policymakers and just people and broadly in general?
Well, when we started this project a decade ago, there was no publicly available data that set the benchmark in terms of the sort of outcomes that schools were having. You know, various schools had marketing data and that, but there was no representative surveys. So we have now for a decade established that, and that has been a valuable tool. I think it's been a valuable tool for the school communities as well, in which they've had a mirror to hold up. And while overall Christian schools can be very thankful for the results that they have, there are some areas of significant concern that our data has highlighted over the years. And I'm very thankful that many educators have taken that very seriously and taken the challenge to that. And we've tried to work with others and facilitate conversations. We've done a number of innovation summits in the last year. We in Canada, we initiated a teacher's prize just to sort of highlight different practices in the classroom that might change some of these results. So those are, up until now, our data has been used very internal into the community. I think we're sort of a decade in, we're sort of segueing a little bit to take the whole pool of data, obviously continuing to use it to challenge the community to improve, but then also to bring the community together in the sense of not what divides us in terms of our subsectors, but seeing ourselves in this common education enterprise and looking where that can go. We have in the past year commissioned, we're going to be releasing later 11 case studies of schools in Canada that are doing unique things in terms of sustainability from funding and building cohesiveness in their community in terms of civic education. So we've been looking at case studies and giving prizes and trying to highlight some of the things that can be done at a local school level to drive and change results. I also think that one of the next steps, and we're working with various partners thinking about it, we don't have the answer yet, but it's one thing to collect data at an industry-wide level. We now need to build some tools that can be used at much more of a regional, even at a school level, even at a classroom and student level. In this age of technology, in which we've got all sorts of apps and everything else, I think we can do a much better job of holding ourselves to rigorous metrics and to looking at outcomes, to learning both from our successes and failures, and to share them, not viewing them as something proprietary to give us a leg up, but something that we've been blessed by God to discover about the process of education, what makes a quality education, and to share it with our neighbors and to try to improve the education for everyone.
Ray, you know, one last question as we kind of think about this, and you've talked about, and I want to bring it back to a little bit to kind of the language and how we frame the conversation in a generous way, but then how we, you know, how that language reframes us. Like, you know, and I've heard you kind of mention a few of those things here. As you look at the data and as you look at kind of what you've learned over the years, and I know you've talked, you know, you've shared with me like how surprised you were in some ways that, you know, how this took off and how people have responded to it. But how would you encourage people to have, you know, as you prepare for these case studies and as you prepare for the United States data to come out, how would you, you know, encourage people who are educators, who are people that care about this same stuff, to maybe shift even their thinking or their language around these ideas?
Yeah, I think there are several elements of the message that need to be there. We need to consciously think about. One is we are engaged in a common educational enterprise for the good of society in which every student matters. So a very inclusive, broad view of education. The education of, obviously as a parent, I'm going to be most concerned about my own kids. And I have a God-given responsibility and, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a United Nations declared human right to do that. Obviously, there, you know, we believe in something in terms of how God made the world and structures of families and parental responsibilities. But sometimes I think we mistakenly have narrowed education as purely the exercise of a family responsibility and neglected the broad public or civic element of it. And I am educating my children to use their God-given potential, but also to love God and neighbor. And part of loving neighbor is to view this with a sense of the common good. So that would be the first thing. The second is a very holistic view of education. I think we've talked about before the fact that one of the things we're very attentive to in the CARDIS education data is not just to measure outcomes of education based on educational attainment, how many graduates go to college and how many get PhDs and master's degrees. We have focused on spiritual formation. We have focused on civic engagement. We're called to educate whole people for whole life obedience to Christ. So there is a holistic approach, and that needs to be there also in terms of the metrics, in terms of what we measure. Let's not just settle with, you know, attainment scores and standardized tests. Let's have a much more robust set of metrics that we hold ourselves to, because I think that reflects a Christian anthropology, a Christian understanding of who we're dealing with. And the image of God is not just to be seen in my kids. It's to be seen in the neighbor's kids. It's to be seen in that disadvantaged kid who right now is not being given a great opportunity in either the public or the non-government sector schools. We need to find a way to educate all of the children in our society in the best possible way. And I, you know, that leads to all sorts of systemic sort of things. You know, when I think back, you asked earlier about models of opportunity. I think back to, you know, many of the Catholic schools in the 50s and 60s in the United States that served inner cities, that were a significant benefit to economic and social mobility for a lot of people. And you know, those numbers have shrunk. I'm not sure, I worry a little bit that sometimes Christian education has become a middle class project, serving the upper and middle class, and you know, both within Christian communities as well as in society as a whole, we've not figured out ways to make it attainable and sustainable. So I think it's rethinking the project of Christian education with these foundational principles in mind. And where possible, of course, making incremental changes, but fundamentally changing the conversation and hopefully setting the stage for far more changes in terms of the framework of what we're doing.
Ray, I truly appreciate your time, your expertise and wisdom, and always enjoy these conversations. So thank you.
Thank you very much for having me, and look forward to when our paths cross again.